Well, let's see. There's a Fed meeting, a healthcare bill, NAFTA as well, and so much more from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the third day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Republicans in the House and Republicans in the White House, it should be said, are pushing hard to get a vote done on the GOP's health care plan. There is legislative horse trading and arm twisting going on as we speak, but there is also a fundamental economic reality at play here as well. Lawmakers are trying to change the health care market, but are ignoring market forces. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The requirement that insurance companies cover people with pre-existing conditions is a really popular one. The challenge now is, how do you pay for them? Dan Mendelson is president of Avalere Health.
That is really what a lot of the debate is around. It's individuals who do not have insurance who need it.
Now, the basic model of health insurance is pretty simple. The healthy help pay for the sick. So Obamacare's solution to paying for people with pre-existing conditions was to push more healthy people to buy insurance plans, penalize those who don't, and subsidize some who do. More healthy people paying, more sick people get covered. Republicans do not want to do that, and their challenge is figuring out an alternative.
So like, imagine we're making a model airplane. They sort of want to make one with one wing and one landing gear, but not sort of actually think about, what does it take to make this insurance airplane fly off the ground?
Craig Garthwaite directs the Kellogg School's healthcare program. The Republican alternative being considered at this point is to say, sure, insurance companies still can't deny people with pre-existing conditions, but they can charge them more. Larry Levitt is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
So in theory, insurance companies might have to take these people, but you can bet they're going to charge them astronomical premiums to keep them out of their pool.
So the healthy would still pay for the sick. There would just be fewer sick people with insurance.
That would have the effect of lowering premiums significantly for people who are healthy, but likely pricing people who are sick out of the market.
That could be a lot of people. 27% of adults have pre-existing conditions that would have resulted in denial of private insurance before Obamacare. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
It's not all health care and funding the government in the House. You know, Republicans have passed a bill that would let employers give workers paid time off instead of the time and a half they are normally due in overtime pay. That is actual cash. It's officially called the Working Families Flexibility Act. Flexibility for whom, though, is the question. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
The bill made its way through the House without picking up a single Democratic vote. Speaking on the House floor yesterday, Representative Martha Roby of Alabama says the aim is to simply give workers greater control of their time.
Should a working dad be forced to use up all of his vacation time in order to get involved in his child's school? Should a military mom with her husband deployed have to dip into her sick leave to make sure her kids have the support they need?
Roby says employees won't be required to take paid time off in lieu of overtime. Still, opponents claim it would open the door for companies to dodge paying workers what they've earned. Celine McNicholas is labor counsel for the Progressive Economic Policy Institute.
This bill does not provide a single new benefit to workers. What it does is it creates a new right for employers.
McNicholas says comp time arrangements are already allowed under current law, and under this bill, employers could dictate when and how that benefit is paid out.
They would have the right, employers would have the right to delay paying workers for earned overtime wages, and they could hold on to that pay for as long as 13 months.
Senator Elizabeth Warren says she seriously doubts the bill will be supported by the 8 Democrats needed to pass in the Senate.
Congress should be strengthening protections for workers, not gutting the protections that are already on the books.
A similar bill was passed by the House in 2013 and died in the Senate. President Trump says he'll sign the measure if it reaches his desk. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
There's some data out today from the real estate research firm Trulia that shows an uneven recovery in the housing market. Uneven is too gentle a phrase, perhaps. Company says only 34% of homes nationally have returned to their pre-recession value. Now, think back to before the crash and those housing values back then. Right. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more now on the importance of using a proper benchmark.
truly have found a lot of geographic variation in where the housing market has and hasn't recovered from its pre-recession highs. Ralph McLaughlin is Trulia's chief economist.
So, for example, you know, over 98% of homes in places like San Francisco and Dallas have recovered, compared to less than 3% in places like Las Vegas and Tucson, Arizona.
Those numbers may seem alarming, but housing economist Elliot Eisenberg says home values don't have to get back to where they were before the Great Recession.
That was just a prior high. So I think psychologically, people enjoy saying, oh, we're near, at, or above by X percent from the prior high. Those prices were all unreasonable. Across the board, they were unreasonable.
Just think of all the speculation going on back then and how home buyers got home loans without income verification. Dave Tina is president of the Greater Las Vegas Association of Realtors. He recalls visiting a new home community back during the housing boom. There was a line of potential buyers coming out the door of a model home.
The first person who bought the first house, it was $400,000. The second person who bought a house, it was $420,000, $440,000, $460,000. They were literally raising the price per person as they walked in. I said, I think we're in trouble.
He says the median home price in the greater Las Vegas area peaked around $315,000. Now it's $242,000. But Tina tells clients that's just fine. It's almost double where it was 5 years ago.
So it's kind of a nice in between. I keep saying we're stable.
At least that's what he hopes. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The macroeconomic word of the day today is transitory. I'll explain that one in a minute. On Wall Street on this Wednesday. Yeah, no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So, transitory. Remember we told you last week about lousy economic growth in the first quarter and how Q1 weakness isn't really all that unusual because of how analysts adjust for seasonal variations? Well, today the Fed weighed in, wrapping up a two-day meeting on interest rates. First of all, no rate hikes, by the way. The Fed said in its statement that it believes the economic weakness January through March was transitory. Translating, if I might, you can go ahead and look for an interest rate increase at the Fed's June meeting, which gets us to who might be sitting around that big conference table at the Fed as the Trump presidency proceeds. During the next year or so, President Trump is going to have a chance to fill as many as five vacancies on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, possibly including the top spot, because Janet Yellen's term as chair is up early next year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at the Trump effect on the Fed.
President Trump could ask Janet Yellen to stay on as Fed chair. Here's what he said in a Wall Street Journal interview a few weeks ago. He was asked, would he consider reappointing Yellen or was she toast?
No, not toast. No, I like her. I respect her.
It's not clear how Yellen feels about staying. At a press conference last December, she was asked, would she accept another term as Fed chair if Trump reappointed her?
I haven't made any decision about the future. I recognize I might or might not be reappointed.
But let's say Yellen does not stay and she leaves the Fed next February. Trump would then be able to appoint a Fed chair plus as many as five of the seven members of the Fed's Board of Governors who serve 14-year terms. The governors are a major force in setting interest rates, along with regulating and supervising some of the nation's biggest financial institutions.
It's a remarkable situation.
That's Andrew Levin, a former Fed economist now teaching economics at Dartmouth College. He says, think about this happening on the Supreme Court.
Imagine that in the course of a year and a half, the President of the United States would be appointing the Chief Justice and three or four or five of the other justices. And that's essentially the situation for the Federal Reserve Board.
There were already two vacancies on the Fed board when Trump took office. Another Fed governor resigned last month, and Fed Vice Chair Stanley Fisher's term expires several months after Chair Yellen's term is up. So, what types of people will President Trump appoint? He's chosen business people for other top positions. Anat Admati says he may do the same thing at the Fed. She teaches finance and economics at Stanford University.
I would be quite concerned if the Fed was filled with bankers. I think there are conflicts of interest between the interests of Wall Street and the interests of society.
On regulation, for example, the Federal Reserve is in charge of implementing some of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. Admati says Dodd-Frank isn't perfect, but she hopes Trump doesn't appoint Fed governors who are against any kind of bank regulation. David Kotok, the head of Cumberland Advisors, doesn't think Trump will go that far. Still,
markets expect the Trump Fed to have a lighter regulatory touch.
Kotok is worried that Trump will appoint Fed governors who want to keep interest rates too low, sparking inflation. Now, all seven Fed governors are on the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets interest rates. So, Kotok points out, Trump will be nominating a big block of people who will have a huge say in the direction of interest rates.
Appointments are going to be made by a president who made money in the real estate business, who was a borrower. Of course he likes low interest rates. That is something that some of us in the financial community are concerned about.
But Kotok says he's not overly worried. At this point, he thinks Trump will appoint what he calls centrist Fed governors who won't push interest rates too low or ease up too much on regulation. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's some deeply political news out of the Washington policy world this week that's pretty broadly economic as well. Former GOP South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint is out as the president of the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank that's had a whole lot of influence on the aforementioned Washington policy world the past 40 years or so. Molly Ball covers politics for The Atlantic. Molly, thanks for coming on the program.
Great to be here.
How did Heritage get to be Heritage, capital H?
Well, the Heritage Foundation has a storied history in the conservative movement dating back to the 1970s, even as before Ronald Reagan was elected, when conservatism was really starting to gain respectability as an ideology and as a philosophy, as a set of ideas. And then once you get Ronald Reagan elected, the Heritage Foundation presented the incoming president with 2,000 ideas in a 20-volume package. And Ronald Reagan handed it out to every single member of the cabinet in the first meeting. And by the end of his first year in office, Heritage estimated that 60% of those ideas had been put into practice in some way by the president.
So amazingly effective, not just productive, not just voluminous, but effective, too.
That's right. The idea was that it was a think tank in the sense that they were providing ideas of academic caliber, but they were also an action tank. They were getting those ideas put in front of policymakers. At the same time, they were also policing the debate. They were not afraid to tell Reagan when they thought he was not conservative enough. They blasted Reagan when he sought to do things like raise taxes. Every Republican president and many Republican politicians have drawn the scorn of Heritage for not being quite right-wing enough. And that was a trend that really began to intensify over the course of the Obama administration.
Well, let me back up for a minute. It bears a mention here that, it had influence in Democratic circles as well. Clinton and welfare reform, for one.
Yes, I don't think that you could say that the Heritage Foundation had the same kind of clout in the Clinton administration as it did in the Reagan administration. But it is true that these ideas began to gain actually bipartisan credence because they were seen as a sort of constructive contribution from the right side of the aisle. So you had the welfare reform that Bill Clinton ended up enacting, inspired in part by ideas that came from the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation also in the 1990s came up with the idea of an individual mandate to buy health insurance as a conservative means of enacting universal health care. Hmm. Now, the Heritage Foundation ended up distancing itself from that idea, but it was very famously the basis of the sorts of health care plans that were put into place, first of all, by Governor Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and then by President Obama on a national scale.
Let's get to present day then and President Trump. He cited Heritage on the campaign trail more than once. They gave him a budget blueprint as he was going into the White House, right?
A lot of Heritage's ideas now have traction in this current White House. But at the same time, the struggle for Heritage now is a part of the bigger struggle over what it means to be a conservative in the Trump era. The blueprint that Heritage has established in recent years looks much more like a Ted Cruz. And so it has struggled to, as all conservative institutions have, adjust itself to how to deal with this new president.
Well, it's interesting, actually, now, just as Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said as Republicans take over unified government in Washington, that governing is hard versus being in opposition. True for lawmakers, clearly, and also now true for think tanks and those on the outside trying to affect policy.
What I draw from this is that even though Republicans have consolidated control of the White House and both houses of Congress, your sort of previously scheduled Republican civil war is still underway. The same conflicts that so racked the party throughout the Obama years and during the Republican primaries, those are still going on, and those players are still fighting over what it means to be a Republican.
Molly Ball, she covers politics for The Atlantic. Molly, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Coming up,
the life of a chicken is not that great when you get right down to it.
No, no, it's not. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 8 points today, less than a tenth percent, 20,957. The NASDAQ off 22.3%, 6,072. S&P 500 down 3 points, about a tenth percent, 23.88. Apple reported modest growth in revenue and earnings yesterday, also acknowledged a dip in iPhone sales. Apple investors went, yeah, it's still Apple. Shares down 0.3%. IBM off 0.2%. Microsoft down 0.3%. Etsy surprised with a loss yesterday versus a profit of more than $1 million a year ago. Also, by the by, a change in CEOs. Stock took a 7.7% hit on that news. Amazon shares down 0.6%. Today, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.32%. Fed? What Fed? You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And you have a lot of questions for us about business and technology.
Is automation going to take over even white-collar careers?
Do we actually make enough steel to construct large-scale infrastructure projects?
What is IBM Watson?
Watson, turns out, is a supercomputer that can probably beat you at chess and might even help you with your taxes.
Want to know more? I know you do. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are, as yet, unsure what the fate of the North American Free Trade Agreement is going to be. The president, as you might remember, walked back his threat to pull out of the thing a couple of weeks ago, for the time being, he said, which is my cue to introduce an oldie but a goodie for businesses in this economy, that whole idea of being unsure, uncertainty. Businesses hate it, especially when you're talking about a deal the size of NAFTA. Businesses that depend on cross-border trade. From Houston Public Media, Andrew Schneider has the story on the hoof.
For 3 weeks each year, more than 2 million people converge on Houston for the city's annual livestock show and rodeo. Many come for the entertainment, country music stars, bronco busting, and bull riding. But this is also a trade show, one that attracts buyers from all over the world and U.S. ranchers ready to sell to them.
My name is Coleman Locke, and I'm from Hungerford, Texas. Our family ranch is J.D. Hudgens Incorporated, and we have been in business since 1908.
Locke says Mexico has long been one of the most important foreign markets for J.D. Hudgens. The family ranch sells cattle south to Mexican ranchers who breed them with their own stock. Then they sell the calves back to the U.S., where they're fattened, slaughtered, and sold for beef.
So the profit on those animals will be made in this country.
And the largest foreign buyer of Texas beef? Mexico. Economist Luis Ribera heads the Center for North American Studies at Texas A&M University.
We export as a U.S. about $975 million to Mexico and about $758 million to Canada. That's just beef and veal.
In fact, Mexico is now the third largest export market for American beef. Only Japan and South Korea buy more.
My name is Kelly Sullivan, and I am co-owner of Santa Rosa Ranch.
Sullivan's family, too, has been in the beef industry for more than a century.
prior to, for example, NAFTA being passed, there was a 25% tariff on our beef.
I asked Sullivan if she's concerned about the potential for trade disputes between the U.S. and Mexico to hurt her business.
What we do know is that President Trump is a businessman and understands the importance of having markets available for products.
Coleman Locke thinks much the same.
I feel confident that he will have our beef organizations at the bargaining table, and we'll be taking advice from them.
Kent Backus is one of those men at the bargaining table. Backus is director of international trade for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Washington, D.C., and he's not nearly so optimistic.
Quite frankly, we're worried that if there are any significant changes made in NAFTA, it'll jeopardize our ability to remain competitive.
Backus says Trump has already dealt beef producers a blow by pulling America out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The TPP would have lowered trade barriers to Japan. He notes that Australia, America's lead competitor there, enjoys an 11% tariff rate advantage over the U.S.
As a result, we've been losing about $400,000 per day in potential sales. And the good thing about TPP is it would have eliminated that gap and leveled the playing field on day one.
Backus notes that beef has long been a target for retaliation in trade disputes, particularly with Mexico. He's lobbying hard to make sure the administration understands what's at stake with NAFTA, because if that trade agreement unravels, his members will be among the first hurt. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider for Marketplace.
So that was beef in the global economy. How about some chicken in this economy? Courtesy of the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest school district in the country, I should mention. After a two-year absence and the breakdown of negotiations between the district and Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride, chicken's looking to get back on lunchroom menus as the LAUSD thinks not just about what to feed the kids, but about where that food is coming from. Howard Bloom writes about education for the Los Angeles Times. Howard, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
How did we get to the point where there is a chicken comeback happening in the cafeterias of the Los Angeles Unified School District?
Well, before the comeback, there was the shortage, and the shortage had to do with LA Unified trying to enforce higher standards on not only the chickens, but the way the chicken workers were treated, the way the environment was treated by the chicken plants. The marketplace is changing for chicken. You're finding, I mean, if you go on to a chicken supplier's website, you will now see them boasting about products that are chickens that have never been fed antibiotics, that have oregano-tinted water, et cetera, as an antioxidant. But still, wow. The life of a chicken is not that great when you get right down to it. And LA Unified was interested in the nutritional quality of its chicken and the whole chicken supply chain. And what they found out was that no one could meet their standards.
Is there a chance that because it is so big, the LAUSD could sort of lead the way, not just elsewhere in California, but across the country in school districts deciding that this is what they're going to do with this menu item for their kids that's going to cost more but has social value to it?
I think LA Unified has led the way, and we beat up on LA Unified a lot here in Los Angeles and at the Los Angeles Times. But if we're looking for something, say, to give them credit for, they have led the way on this issue, even though, as with many activist policies pursued by the school district, it does cost more money.
We should point out here that the entire issue of school lunches, chicken or not, is amazingly complicated. Not only is there the cost, but there are federal nutrition standards. There's the preparation on site issues. There's the supply chain. I mean, there's all kinds of things that districts have to think about when they consider what goes on the kids' plate when they stand in that food lunch line.
That's right. And LA Unified has not just been focused on chicken. They also have a program to purchase locally produced fruits and vegetables, for example, and that has been a big boon to the local providers of that. They outlaw junk food in their vending machines. They now serve breakfast in the classroom. With the fact that they have this expanded food program and thus can hire more workers. So there's nothing simple in education. I also should point out that LA Unified has hired a chef at some point. But, you know, after you produce this food in a central kitchen and wrap it up and reheat it, even if it started off delicious, it may not be as good. And delicious is in the eye of the beholder. Right. What a lot of kids are used to eating is not is more delicious than nutritious, shall we say.
Howard Bloom, he covers education for the Los Angeles Times. Howard, thanks very much.
Happy to do it.
Final note on the way out today. Perhaps you saw the earnings report for the New York Times this morning. Lots of new subscriptions, making good money, all of the things you would expect in a challenging news environment. Here's my favorite part of the whole thing, though. 40,000 new digital subscribers to the Times crossword last quarter. I think that's great, just, you know, etymologically speaking. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 8 points today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ down 22, 0.3%. S&P 500 off 3 points, about a 0.1%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.